Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. In 2011, the city of Albuquerque launched its Heading Home initiative. The idea was to shift how it was addressing homelessness by putting housing first. It has targeted the most vulnerable people experiencing chronic homelessness who have health issues, including behavioral health challenges. Since its launch, it has housed more than 600 people. The University of New Mexico Institute for Social Research did an in-depth analysis of the program recently and found it's costing the city less to house someone than to keep them homeless. I'm joined today by Paul Guerin, who led the study for the Institute for Social Research at UNM. Also joining me is Dennis Plummer with the Heading Home program and James Coleman, who's been housed for 4 years because of Heading Home. Thank you for joining me today, you all.
Thank you for having us.
So, Dennis, tell us first, what is the idea behind Heading Home? Why does it represent a shift in how Albuquerque dealt with homelessness previously?
What was different this time was to look at people based on prioritization of need. So in the past, when we had a chronological list, it was whoever had walked through the door and we would help that person first. And yet, if you think of the ER room, if somebody comes in with a heart attack, you don't tell them to wait in line and you still take the next person who's been there longest.
You're really triaging the most severe cases.
And then once we do that, we also do the wraparound support in a unique way, which is every 2 weeks, about 9 different agencies come together, their staff, and really look at everyone who's being housed or who is housed and does some crisis management or some assistance management. So rather than the client going from door to door across agencies, the agencies come together themselves and look at how we can best take the services to the people in need.
And a lot of programs in the past, you had to be clean and sober. You had to have a certain things in place before you could be considered
right.
for housing.
And as a community, we've come to realize that Housing First is really the model that works. The Supportive Housing Coalition of New Mexico has been doing Housing First, and through their data and then now our own with Paul's research, looking at does it work to really wait until somebody is no longer in their worst need to then house or to put housing first? And you think about it, you or I or any of us who are trying to make life changes, to do that while trying to survive on the street is extremely difficult. So we've really learned that to meet people where they are, provide the housing, and then move from there. Because once housed, then it's obviously much easier to make medical appointments and really reach out for the assistance that you need.
Paul Guerin, the Institute for Social Research was commissioned by the city of Albuquerque to study this program. So what were the primary takeaways from the evaluation that you did?
So I think in some respects, our study is unique in the country. So this is not the first time that a study like this has been done. But our study is a little bit different because our study expands the range of services we look at in order to get costs. So primarily, Housing First studies or studies of similar type like this have looked at hospitalization costs. So the primary interest is, how much does it cost to hospitalize someone before, both in emergency rooms, inpatient, outpatient, before and then after they've been housed? So our study does that, but our study does a little bit more. So our study also looks at other associated costs. So just like that, we know that individuals who are homeless oftentimes come in contact with medical services or hospitals. They also come in contact with a lot of other services. In our case, we were interested in criminal justice services. So we have jail costs, we have arrest costs. And we were also looking at additional costs. So we were looking at outpatient behavioral health, outpatient substance abuse. We were looking at shelter costs and those types of costs. So our costs really expand from what has historically been done. And oftentimes, services that are even looking at hospitalization look at public hospitals, but we actually use private hospitals. So we have information not only from the university hospital, but we have information from Loveless and we have information from Presbyterian.
So you guys found that for every dollar spent on the program, there were $1.78 in benefits. What does that mean exactly?
We're looking at an economic return. So if you spend a dollar, you're getting back $1.78. in return. Even if there was a small loss, in my view, there's actually a social return that's even more beneficial that we didn't account for and could be in the future.
James Coleman, can I ask you, how did you get to the Heading Home program? What led you to being on the streets for so long?
I really can't pinpoint exactly, but I do know that kind of a rough upbringing and depression that I suffered from. I don't know if it's inherited or what, but it was a big issue. I really can't pinpoint exactly why. The divorce in 1986 had a lot to do with it.
So you had been married and you had a home,
yes,
and a life, and then you ended up on the streets for 10 years.
When I was homeless, or when I got divorced, that was boom, out on the streets. And after a little stay in a psychiatric hospital, was suggested I go see St. Martin's. So that is, in fact, what I did, and began this relationship that I have now with St. Martin's and heading home.
I think it must probably be very isolating.
Yes, and of course, you learn, you see how people treat you differently when they realize, you know, that you're homeless, and I don't know what it is that they see. They shun you right off the bat. I don't know if they have a vacancy in that spot in their life where they need somebody to pick on, but you're isolated, very alone, feeling what the purpose is of life in general is what I struggled with, you know. So, but grace of God, you know, Paul and Dennis and the people at St. Martin's, and since then, my housing, I've been to school, CNM, I got my CDL, commercial driver's license, and became gainfully employed for a while, driving the big rigs, and been a blessing from day one, almost 5 years now.
Dennis, you know, James is talking about dealing with depression. How common is this?
It's extremely common, and we know that about 83% and more suffer from mental challenges, mental health issues. And if you think about it, one of our volunteers stated it really well. He made the observation. He's actually a UNM retired professor of journalism. He volunteers at our shelter, and he said before volunteering, he had always suspected that drugs and alcohol led to homelessness. And what he had found by his own observation was that it was oftentimes the result of being homeless as coping mechanism. So in James' case, with your suffering some depression, history in the family, once you're on the street, that is so compounded and just becomes that much more acute.
So when we're talking about, going back to what Paul is talking about, we have, you know, they looked at the economic return. We're talking about the social return. Mm-hmm. How do we quantify this?
One gentleman who had been housed and had been disabled in 98, a veteran, had been on the streets and very difficult to get through the system. And once we were able to get him housing, we discovered with him that he was owed $40,000 in back pay from the Veterans Administration. And I learned of that when he came to my office with a $1,000 check and said, "You go help somebody else." So I know that those type of returns aren't quantified necessarily. We don't know their eventual income or contribution back to society as far as a community of involvement, volunteerism, seeing families reunited and realizing that we're disrupting the future cycle of homelessness for the children in that family is, again, something that's very difficult to quantify, but we do see it and know that it's happening.
So, James, what's, now that you are in a stable place with help, what does your life look like now?
I actually have a good outlook. Future-wise, I've been working on a program that Dennis and I have been discussing that deals directly with the homeless and support of the homeless individuals. We'll see if I can get this thing off the ground and in the near future and be someone that the homeless can go to on an open-door policy, you know, no restrictions, just there to help, you know. Understanding, because I have been homeless before, and you know, I don't have the formal education in a university, so to speak, as Dennis has a bachelor's degree and stuff. But I do know the ins and outs and the ropes of having to be homeless. It's pretty uncomfortable.
James is a real entrepreneur too. I know that as he's mentioned, we've been talking about some ideas that he has. So ideas, which I find really intriguing as far as business proposals, but always, in this case, James is linking it back to helping others. So at the core is he, as you mentioned, James, it's how can you be a listening ear, kind of a peer specialist, somebody who's been there, able to be a listening ear. So I just find it so inspiring that people, one of the first things that they ask for after cleaning supplies for their homes are ways that they can get involved and to volunteer and give back to the community. And I think, again, that goes to your point and Paul's point about the intangible social benefits that come back.
This is University Showcase on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick, and I'm speaking with Dennis Plummer with Albuquerque Heading Home, James Coleman, who has been housed through Heading Home after years of living on the streets, and Paul Guerin with the Institute of Social Research at the University of New Mexico. The Institute did a study on Heading Home and found that for every dollar the city spent, it saw $1.78 in benefits.
Paul, I wanted to ask you this kind of a wonky question. When you were looking at evaluating this program, the methodology, can you talk just a little bit about that?
What we hoped to do is we hoped just to ask people to participate in our study. So as individuals like James Coleman became enrolled in housing, he was approached by either someone on our staff or someone on the Heading Home staff and simply asked if they'd like to participate in the study. We asked them primarily for two things. We asked them to talk to us first, to ask them how they were doing then, and to collect information about them before they were housed and at the point they were housed. And then we also asked them at that time to allow us to speak to them at a later point in time, maybe a year or so after they'd been housed, to ask them how they were doing at that point compared to when they came in. And the second thing we asked them to do was to sign a consent that would allow us to go to places that they might have been prior to they were housed and after they were housed. So we asked them to allow us to go to places like the University Hospital, Loveless, Presbyterian, the local jail, the local law enforcement agencies, the local shelters, the local substance use treatment facilities that were public, mental health facilities that were public, and simply just ask those places to provide us any information about them while they had been at those places. And we gathered that information. So that part is probably the most arduous part in itself, is just contacting these places, gaining permission, providing them the consents, and then gathering that information and putting it in a way that is useful for us and that we could report those kind of findings. So we literally have in our study 95 study group members that we recruited over a period of time. And in our study, we report on most of them. And we talk about literally those costs that they incurred prior to they were housed and after they were housed. And we simply compare those costs and we look at the changes in those costs.
So is that a good representative sample? You didn't talk to every single person because not everyone wanted to participate. But is that a pretty good sample to extrapolate?
Sure. So at the time that we conducted our study, we recruited 95 people out of about 300 that were eligible to participate in our study.
We were relying on studies that were being touted nationwide as being kind of the exemplar of the proof that this type of thing would work. And their sample sizes were 17. And so to jump to Paul's study and to see the remarkable feat of his team in gathering that much information, it's a very significant study.
Now, I know since folks like James, once you have housing, that is, do people pay a percentage of the rent based on their income? Is that usually how it works?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 30% of the income. Right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then there's services that wrap around the individual.
Yes.
So are those are some added costs, but that's balanced by the other costs that are decreasing, like in the ER visits.
There are two things there that I want to describe the services, if I may,
mm-hmm.
Because I think when you asked earlier what is unique about what we're doing in Albuquerque, because there are Housing First programs that follow this model around the country. We're certainly not the first there. But besides the cross-agency and all of our partnership in the community, a couple of things we've added which are, I think, invaluable are things like move-in assistance. So when James went into an apartment, to be able to have our staff and volunteers deliver furniture to outfit the apartment. Secondly, we have a monthly gathering that anyone who's been housed is welcome to come to. It's a large dinner where people share, and we have some additional household items we can distribute. And then thirdly, we have what are called home teams, comprised of four or five community volunteers who commit to a year of partnership with our new neighbor or their family. And so that's just to really introduce some new social networking activities. It can be as simple as cooking dinner together, going to a movie. And that's really a life changer, not only for the people who have been recently housed, but also for the volunteers. And it begins to build a new social network. And as for the added cost, Paul can talk to this more precisely, but I do believe, at least in the first study, we saw an increase in social service costs go up over 400%. It does show an increase in utilization of social services. And even with that new cost, we're still seeing the overall savings. And again, I think that goes to the philosophy of Housing First, which is people will actually utilize and reach out to the resources that are there if they have a place of stability from which to begin. It's in, as in Maslow's hierarchy, shelter being one of the basic human needs, meeting that first, then people go on to self-actualize, and then you start seeing the utilization and recovery.
And is the cost of the program is paid entirely by the city of Albuquerque?
It's a number of resources. Certainly the city is a primary driver behind this, and Mayor Barry and the city council have been extremely supportive and really pushing this to the next level. We also rely a lot on individual donations, corporate donations. We're always trying to shake the tree for money wherever we can find it, because for a while we were operating at a bit of a loss, absorbing the cost and offsetting it through other sources. But now the city has again come behind it, and we hope the new administration next year will double down on that and will continue to help more people.
I think it's also important to point out, though, that our study includes people who left their housing. Mm-hmm. So there's specifically people in our study who left their housing, and even after they leave their housing, we see a decrease in costs in total. At some level, people receive benefits just simply by being housed, and at some level, it appears that those benefits extend beyond the time that they're housed, so that they continue to receive benefits. And I think that that's an important thing to understand here. I think it's also important that this study was begun using federal dollars. So the city competitively received a grant from the federal government for 3 years that funded part of the study, and in fact, for the first 3 years, funded our research. And I think that that's important to point out and to understand as well.
Can I just clarify for folks? So is there any pressure when you are receiving funding for a certain outcome?
The kind of pressures that you're suggesting do exist, but in this case, they don't. So I've said this in other venues that this was actually interesting for the city to do, because the city didn't have to do this. So then when they received the federal monies, they didn't have to have a study like this. It's primarily several people within the city that are pushing to have this study. And one of those is the mayor, who, being in a pragmatic kind of way, wants to know whether there's a benefit to this program. And I think that if there is a benefit, then you would choose to extend that benefit and move that program forward. And if there weren't, then you would try to do something else. So this is just being fiscally responsible. But if our findings would have come out in a different way, that's just the way that they would have come out.
And we were very clear from the beginning, if it didn't work, we weren't going to keep doing it. And I found Paul over time has become a good friend as well as a colleague, infuriatingly vigorous in his research. And so just I have such confidence in the results because of that vigorousness of Paul's work. And so looking at this, I'm assured that exactly the findings are as he found them. And that gives me some confidence and our team some confidence, too, to know that we have some solid basis from which to go forward.
What are policymakers saying? What do they want to do going forward?
There may be two answers to that. One is a large bipartisan support to expand the program, but lack of funding. But the second part of that is, and this is probably speaking to your listeners who are funders, is the lack of funding for ongoing research like this. Most organizations, like my own nonprofits, are tasked with delivery of services. And we very, very seldom have an opportunity to examine our own practices and outcomes. We just have to, at the end of 12 months, report back to a funder, this many people were served. And so I think it benefits us greatly to have solid research like this and to have funding that allows us to do longitudinal study beyond a 12-month turnaround point to look at the questions that Paul's raising. I think that's what our political leaders are also asking for, is more evidence-based outcomes. And so we really need to be able to invest in that for data.
If you just joined us, this is University Showcase on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick. We're talking about Heading Home, the homeless program by the City of Albuquerque, and a new study that found for every dollar the city spends, it sees $1.78 in savings. Paul Guerin led the study for the UNM Institute for Social Research. I'm also joined by Dennis Plummer, Executive Director of Heading Home, and James Coleman, who has been housed through the program after years living on the streets. I'm curious if other cities or counties or states are now interested in looking at the program, especially since your study came out, or looking at evaluations like what you did.
I mean, there has been some interest, I think, in additional research other places. So I have talked to people from other places. I can tell you that specifically here in Bernalillo County, there's increased interest. So I know that the county, through their behavioral health initiative, which is this 8-cent tax, is actually funding a program currently right now of people coming out of the jail, and is possibly going to fund additional programs that may deal with juveniles who are homeless and or adults that are homeless, either in the traditional that we have here, scattered site housing, or proposed ideas that might include a single site, mm-hmm. which for some people may be more beneficial, some individuals.
One of the things that is critical to any model is the housing first that we know works. So that model is essential, and that it's also that it's permanent supportive housing. So once the housing is there, it's not contingent upon participation as into any one program. So what we've seen is, and I imagine this is true, at least it is for me personally, if I'm forced into a program, it's less likely to be meaningful to me. I may go through the action and the motions to get through it. But if I'm offered, again, Maslow's hierarchy, this safety and stability, then I begin out of my own volition to participate. And so I think any model that's used has to have it at its core those two critical pieces, the housing first, and that it is permanent supportive housing that's available.
I think there's still a general misunderstanding of the homeless population in the larger community. And I think what this study is able to do, if people were to know about it and to pay attention to it, is it talks to people across the spectrum. It's really pragmatic. So that we know now in Bernalillo County, in the city of Albuquerque, that we can house people for less than it cost to keep them on the street in total. So people on the liberal side, more liberal side of the spectrum, they want to see social benefits. It's in their belief system that housing people or having people not be homeless is an important thing. But people who are on a more conservative side, and I'm not saying that they don't have those same feelings as well, but this provides a level of evidence that's worthwhile and meaningful to show that this is a pragmatic approach to house people. And there's more that could be done. And this benefit, again, extends regardless of whether they take advantage of case management services that are available to them and regardless of whether they stay housed. Their outpatient medical costs increase. That's expected. So now people are able in a stable way to go see a doctor where before they had to wait to an emergency to go to an emergency room that may turn into an inpatient visit, which is much more expensive, or that people were coming in contact frequently with the criminal justice system. And we know that there's a relationship between people who are homeless and the criminal justice system. People who are homeless are more likely to come in contact. People who are released from prison are much more likely to become homeless. This is a way, using this model, to target particular portions of the population that we can benefit and reduce costs for.
And our tagline is, it's the smart way to do the right thing. It saves your wallet. It saves your heart. It brings our community back together. Like for me, I'm not okay knowing that people are sleeping on the street. I want to see it be the smart way to do the right thing. You mentioned other eyes. We have had the city of Anaheim or the county of Anaheim, California, send staff over for 2 days of training to see how this model works. We had the mayor's office of Lexington, Kentucky, sent staff for a 2-day training as well. We've been down to Tucson, Arizona, and in conversation with them about not that we're the first in this, but what are the unique things that Albuquerque has added to the model that have really made it a full-fledged success that it has been.
So we know certain things work and we know other things don't. But we could be more efficient in trying to spend those resources and trying to improve services. So you already noted that, you know, there's people who were lost to the program. Well, in my belief, the program, if they chose to be a little more efficient or decide how they were going to do things a little bit differently, would better track and follow those people. I also think, and this is my experience, that there are people who are employable who currently aren't employed, and it is difficult work to try to get those people employed. But my belief is that if we employed more of these people, we'd in fact see a greater benefit. If we were able to follow these people and keep them engaged in housing and services for longer periods of time, we would improve stability.
I wholeheartedly agree. Yeah. And this, I couldn't stress enough the need for funders and the community at large to begin to realize that low overhead is not the mark of a good organization. If we add a person on our staff to track our data, which means addresses, follow up with where people are, that's not a service, and so that's overhead. And then when we want to really look at it in a study like Paul's, we realize huge chunks of data are not there that need to be so much better tracked.
And I think that this program does. If you look at the data we have, this program houses the most vulnerable people. And yet, there are any number of folks who are homeless who could use services. So I knew James for a while, and we kept in touch for a while. And after James, I've kept in touch with several others as well. And one of them, he that I currently know, he's been homeless 3 years on the street and literally camping in a tent. During the winter, he stays on the west side, and he doesn't score high enough on the vulnerability index to be targeted currently for permanent supportive housing. He scores too low. He has a behavioral health disorder. He has been homeless a long period of time, but he's not medically vulnerable. He doesn't seek help. So he doesn't present at hospitals, he doesn't present at the jail, he doesn't do that because he just stays to himself. But in my view, he needs help. Mm-hmm.
We've demonstrated now with the most vulnerable population, medically vulnerable, that this model works. Now what we need is to be able to expand the voucher system and expand the program to all vulnerable populations. So it's behavioral health, it's family, it's youth, it's children, it's because we already know the $1.78 to every dollar return. Why not go ahead and scale up and do this across all the population of people experiencing homelessness?
James, what do you want people to know about folks who are facing homelessness?
Well, I think, first of all, I need to recognize that they're human, just like the homeless individual. And you know, people have faults and problems that are so broadly scattered as the world is now today, that I just believe that people should take a closer look at the discomforts of others in general, and do what they can from their heart, you know. And thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Of course. Thank you all for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Megan.
This has been University Showcase. I want to thank my guests today, Dennis Plummer and James Coleman with Heading Home, and Paul Guerin with the Institute for Social Research at the University of New Mexico. Find his study on the Heading Home program at our website, kunm.org. I'm Megan Kamrick. Thanks for listening.